Tentold Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Quiet Little Town by William W. Johnstone and J. A. Johnstone. Narrated by J. Rodney Turner. Chapter 1. The moment tall Texan Burke Forrester stepped off the steam packet Manxman's gangway onto a London harbor dock, he became the most dangerous man in England, if not the entire British Empire. Forrester's welcoming committee was sleet, driven by an icy wind that cut to the bone, and a cable length away swept the deserted decks of three great ironclads anchored in a dredged deep-water channel, awaiting their turn in dry dock. A few tattered gulls breamed the elements, flapped above the tall masts of the warships and stridently yodeled their hunger. Wearing a black-caped greatcoat and red woolen muffler against the cold, Forrester made his way toward a labyrinth of warehouses, a sugar refinery, and a paper mill that marked the limit of the dock area and began the adjoining industrial district. He'd been the Manx man's only passenger, and there was no one else around. He carried a large carpet bag that contained a change of clothing and a Colt revolver, and in his gloved left hand he held a sword cane with an elaborately carved ivory handle in the shape of a Chinese dragon with emerald eyes. The sword had a 23-inch steel blade, razor sharp, a gentleman's weapon and a deadly one. Forrester's thoughts were on the cab that presumably awaited him, and thereafter a blazing fire, and perhaps a glass of hot rum punch. On that particular Sunday morning in civilized London town, he gave little thought to the cane as a weapon, considering it more of a fashion accessory. In that, he was mistaken. The blade would very soon be called into use, with horrifyingly fatal results. Forrester wore the high-heeled boots and wide-brimmed Stetson of a Western man, and head bent against the slashing sleet. He didn't see the dock worker stride toward him until the man was almost past, his eyes fixed steadily on a point ahead of him. Out of the corner of his mouth, the worker said, "Be careful, Gov." And then he was gone, and Forrester briefly wondered at his warning, and then dismissed it. After all, the English were a polite breed, much given to strange greetings. This was a little-used 100-year-old dock once trodden by Admiral Lord Nelson that was scheduled to be closed. After a couple of minutes of walking, Forrester found himself on a deserted concrete pathway between the paper mill and a rust-colored corrugated iron warehouse. The mill was silent, its pious owner observing the Sabbath. But a massive ship's boiler awaiting the scrap heap took up much of the space on the path, and a pile of empty tea chests had fallen over in the wind and were scattered everywhere. Huge Norwegian rats, afraid of nothing, ignored the approaching human and scuttled and scurried among the debris of 10,000 spilled cargoes. Forrester saw the cab ahead of him, waiting for his arrival as it had for the past 6 days, be his ship early or late. The top-hatted driver, muffled in a greatcoat, a woolen scarf covering his face to the eyes, sat in a spring seat at the rear of the vehicle. Despite the biting, cartwheeling sleet, he seemed to be dozing, and the Texan was close enough that he heard the clang of the impatient horse's hoof as it pawed the wet cobbles. Forrester quickened his pace, desirous of the cab's meager shelter, but he stopped in his tracks as three men, tough-looking brutes wearing flat caps and rough workman's clothing, stepped into his path. The biggest of the three was a ruffian with simian features and massive stoop shoulders. His hands hung at his sides like ham hocks, the knuckles scarred from many a fistfight, and his thick lips were peeled back from decayed teeth in a snarl that passed for a grin. "Air matey, I be Bill Hobson, a well-known name in old London town, and with a toff like you doing a walking around my turf like you owned it," he said. "He's a toff right enough, Bill," another man said. Looks to me that he can pay his way. For a safe passage, like. The human gorilla named Bill widened his grin. Truer words was never spoke, Johnny, he said. Money for a safe passage it is. So give us your wallet and watch, your bag, and whatever other valuables you own. He bowed and waved in the direction of the street. And then you can go in peace. Hand will be taken of your fancy cane, Johnny said. Burke Forrester was irritated at being forced to stop in the middle of a sleet storm. But since his mind was on other, more pressing business, he was willing to let this matter go. After all, three impudent toughs were just a temporary inconvenience. You boys step aside, he said. This is a public thoroughfare, and I have no money for you. He motioned with the cane. Now, be on your way and give me the road. Bill Hobson's gaze became more calculating, measuring the Yankee's height and the width of his shoulders. The man seemed capable, and that gave Bill pause, but more disturbing was the fact that he wasn't in the least bit scared. And he sure as heck should be. Did the dandy know that he was facing three of the toughest men from the violent, disease-ridden cesspit that was the East End of London? Did he realize he faced men who could kick him to death if the need arose? Bill smiled to himself. Maybe the fool needed a harsh lesson. For clarity's sake, it must be noted here that Burke Forrester was a professional assassin and a noted pistolero who'd put the crawl on half a dozen named men, including Wes Harden and the notoriously fast King Fisher. Historians disagree on the number of men Forrester killed, and a man in his line of business didn't boast of it. For him, it sufficed that his reputation was known to the rich and powerful businessmen, industrialists, and cattle ranchers who mattered, and who considered him an efficient and, above all, discreet executioner. Let Forrester's lowest estimated number of kills stand at 63, 58 by the Winchester rifle and Colt's gun, 3 by the Bowie knife, and 2 by his ever-present sword cane. Those numbers are probably near to the truth. In sum, Burke Forrester was a sudden and dangerous killer, and a man best left the hell alone. Something that Bill Hobson and his two companions soon would learn the hard way. Forrester realized that the Englishman's talking was done when the man reached into the pocket of his ragged jacket and produced a lead-filled leather sap, a vicious bone-breaking weapon ideal for a close-range fight against a large opponent. Hobson grinned and tapped his open palm with the sap. "Come and get it, fancy man," he said. Then he swung the blackjack at Forrester's left temple, trying for a killing blow. But the Texan had already moved. He leaped to his right, donned the sap, and with incredible speed and dexterity drew his blade from the sheath. Off balance, Hobson stumbled and desperately tried to regain his footing, his face panicked. But not for long. An accomplished swordsman, Forrester flung his left arm wide and at the same time turned from the waist and elegantly thrust his blade, running Hobson through. 2 feet of steel rammed into his guts will shock a man dreadfully, and Bill Hobson's scream was a shrieking mix of pain, fear, and despair. As the Englishman slowly sank to the sleet-soaked ground groaning, holding his belly with glistening scarlet hands, one of his cohorts turned and scampered. But the third, the man Hobson had called Johnny, slipped a set of brass knuckles onto his right fist and came charging. Forrester was surprised by this aggression and reluctantly recognized the ruffian as a fighting man. It took sand to take on a sword with nothing but a knuckle duster. As a mark of respect, the Texan decided there and then to spare Johnny the pain he'd inflicted on his gutted companion. He backed off a step, away from the man's clumsy swing, and his blade flickered like the tongue of an angry serpent, and the point sank into Johnny's throat, just under his larynx. A quick thrust, and the steel projected 4 inches from the back of the man's neck, and then was withdrawn. Dying on his feet, Johnny stared at Forrester in bewilderment for long seconds, and then sank to the ground, his face in the black liquid mud. Savvy swordsmen never sheathe a bloody blade since it can corrode the steel. Forrester ripped the cloth cap from Hobson's head and wiped the sword as clean as he could. He then took a silk handkerchief from his greatcoat pocket and finished the job. He slid the sword back into the cane as Hobson whispered, scarlet blood in his mouth. "You've killed me." Forrester nodded. "Seems like. You won't survive that wound, my man. Damn you. Damn you to Hades. Better men than you have told me that." "I need a doctor," Hobson said. "Hit me a doctor." Forrester smiled and shook his head. "No, my friend, you don't need a doctor. You need an undertaker. I've got a wife. Four kids still alive," Hobson said. "That's sad. So very tragic," Forrester said. He glanced at the leaden sky. "Well, I can't tarry here talking any longer. Tempus fugit, as they say."
"Don't go, mister. Help me."
"You're beyond help, partner," Forrester said. "All you can do now is die. A balustra, followed by a thrust to the belly, is always fatal." The Texan nodded as though agreeing with himself. "Ah, yes," he said. Then, "Well, I'll be on my way." Hobson, his throat thick with blood, called out something, but Forrester wasn't listening. He made his way to the waiting cab, walking head bent through driving icy sleet, made even colder by a savage north wind. Only the driver's pale blue eyes were visible under the brim of his top hat as he looked down at Forrester, sizing him up as the American gent he was there to meet. "Been waiting long," Forrester said.
6 days long, your worship," the driver said. By his accent, a cockney from the London East End. "From dawn to dusk, me and his here horse."
"The ship was caught by a winter storm in the mid-Atlantic," Forrester said. "We were driven back by the gale, that's why I'm late." The driver's shaggy eyebrows were frosted with rime. He nodded, then said, "I got no time for ships and oceans. I'm a landlubber myself." "Well, I hope they're paying you enough," Forrester said. "It's no fun sitting out for hours in this vile weather."
"That they are," the cabbie said. "They're paying me handsomely."
Then, to Forrester's surprise, he added, "The one who ran away is Charlie Tompkins. He lives with a loose one in East End and hangs out around the docks, thieving whatever he can. He won't snitch to the law, never fear. They'd love to get their hands on old Charlie, the coppers would." Sleet gathered on the shoulders of Forrester's greatcoat, and he was anxious to get inside. "Maybe he'll talk, maybe he won't. But he should be taken care of," he said.
"He will be, and the two dead men back there," the driver said. "Mr. Walzer don't leave no loose ends."
"Ernest Walzer is a careful man," Forrester said.
"That he is," the driver said. "There's a flask of brandy and a box of cigars inside. Help yourself. It's an hour and a half's drive to Mr. Walzer's house, and most of it over cobbles."
Forrester settled in the cab's leather seat, glad to be out of the storm, though the air inside was still bitterly cold. His breath steamed as he poured a brandy from the flask into its silver cup, and then lit a cigar. Back in Texas, his rancher client had paid him well for acting as a go-between, making sure that Ernest Walzer held up his end of the contract, and Forrester decided that he deserved every cent. Nobody warned him about the lousy British weather. Chapter 2.
"Did you have a pleasant crossing, Mr. Forrester?" said Ernest Walzer, a round-shouldered man of medium height,
his intense black eyes dominating a sensitive, fine-boned Semitic face. He wore a ruby-red smoking jacket and a round black hat with a tassel. He had Persian slippers on his feet, and Forrester guessed him to be somewhere in his mid-60s. But he could have been any age. "Pleasant enough until halfway across the Atlantic when we ran into a storm," Forrester said. "Pushed us back toward New York for 4 days." Walter smiled. "I hope you're a good sailor." "I'm not. I was as sick as a poisoned pup the whole time." "Ah, well, you're on dry land now," Walter said. "The sherry is to your taste." "It's just fine," Forrester said. "I'm distressed about your unfortunate encounter with low-class scoundrels," Walter said. "On behalf of my country, I offer you an apology." "A minor incident of no great account," Forrester said. He waved a careless hand, and the blue smoke from his cigar made curling patterns in the air. "Nevertheless, the one called Tompkins will not live out the day," Walter said. "You can be assured of that." He and Walter sat on each side of a blazing long fire in the mansion study that was furnished very much in the current upper-class style, crowded and ornate with well-polished wood, stuffed animals and birds under glass domes, and thick Persian rugs. A portrait of grim old Queen Victoria hung above the fireplace. The room was warm, cozy, hazy from cigar smoke, and spoke of great wealth. Walter studied the Texan for a few moments and then said, "It was Tom Watkins who told me about the difficulty you had at the St. Catherine dock." "The cab driver?" "Yes, I have a dozen cabbies on my payroll. They are my eyes and ears and keep me informed. Rich people are such fools, Mr. Forrester. They pay the driver no heed and indulge in the most intimate conversations. Little do they know that the cabbie up there on his high seat sees and hears everything. And in turn, so do I." "And what do you do with the information?" Forrester asked. Walter shrugged. "Besides my other businesses, I dabble in blackmail and extortion. It's a profitable venture that requires little capital investment." "There were three of them at the dock," Forrester said. "Yes, dock rats, louts, ruffians, the poorest of the poor and of no account," Walter said. "As I said, the one who ran away will be dead by nightfall, and the two you terminated have already been dumped in an East End alley. The authorities won't even investigate. Violent death in all its forms is a daily occurrence in the slums, and seldom do the police get involved. More sherry?" Forrester extended his glass. "Please." Walter refilled from the decanter and said, "You have questions?" An Eastern European accent shaded the man's English, but Forrester didn't notice. To him, all Limeys sounded alike. "Tell me this," the Texan said. "How did my client know you were in this line of work?"
"What line of work?" Walter said.
"Hiring assassins."
"Well, he didn't know, because hiring assassins is not part of my usual business."
Then, frowning, Walter said, "How much of this affair are you entitled to know?" Forrester said, "All of it." The frown didn't leave the older man's face, and the Texan added, "My client trusts me." Walter nodded. "I'm aware of your reputation and your client's faith in you. He made that clear in his letters.
I must confess, I wonder why he didn't hire you for this undertaking. You seemed the ideal man to get the job done."
Forrester shook his head. "No, I'm too close. I've done gun work for my client in the past, and a clever lawman might draw the right conclusions. My client must have no direct connection whatever to the assassins, and I hope you didn't disclose his identity to the men you hired."
Walter said, "Of course I did not. They were told the mark, his location, and nothing else. Professionals need no further information than that. By this time, they're already in Texas.
and when the undertaking is finished, they will scatter and make their separate ways back to London, and then to, well, wherever they hail from.
Forrester said, "Tell me this. How did my client?"
"Between ourselves, let us drop the pretense, Mr. Forrester,"
Walter said. "Your client's name is Gideon Stark,
and he's a big rancher who wants to be bigger, an empire builder who dreams of founding a dynasty. He knows this, and I know this, and it's all that I know.
But at least now our masks have been removed." A few moments of silence stretched between the men. A log fell in the fire and sent up a cascade of scarlet sparks. Sleet battered at the parlor windows, and the frost-rimmed wind raged around the mansion like a ravenous gray wolf.
"All right, then. As you say, our masks are removed," Forrester said. "How did Gideon Stark choose you to take care of this matter?"
"He didn't. At least not directly."
Forrester made no answer.
"This is very much between us," Walter said. "Due to the sensitive nature of what I'm about to tell you, we will deal only in suppositions, Mr. Forrester, not in facts. Do you understand?"
The Texan drew on his cigar before he spoke.
"I catch your drift."
Walter nodded and said,
"Good. Then let us suppose that there's a certain English gentleman rancher in West Texas, the youngest son of a belted earl who is prospering mightily in the cattle business. His fond papa is a nobleman who quickly ran through his wife's inheritance, and now the meager rents from the kilted tenants of his Scottish estates do not support his extravagances, namely gambling and expensive mistresses. The earl is always, as the sporting crowd says, down to his last chip and in the dumps. Let me refill your glass."
Walter poured more sherry and then said,
"Now, shall we surmise, and this is all supposition, mind, that the Earl is a member of the British Foreign Office and desperate for money? Could it be that happenstance threw the wretched blue blood in my direction, and we at once entered into a business arrangement?"
"What kind of business arrangement?" Forrester said.
"If such were the case, one must imagine that money-lending would be the likely arrangement," Walter said. "But then we must answer the question, would a savvy businessman lend money to, as you Americans say, a deadbeat, a worthless, sponging idler like the exalted Earl?"
"I guess not," Forrester said. "Sure doesn't sound like a sound investment."
"And you guess correctly," Walter said. "But what if the nobleman had valuable information to sell because at one time or another his position in the Foreign Office put him in the front parlor of a score of tin-pot dictators and warlords in India, the Orient, and South and Central America? What do such despots need to stay in business, Mr. Forrester?"
"Money," the Texan said.
"High taxes usually provide more than enough of that. No, tyrants need arms, cannon, rifles, carbines, and sabers for their cavalry, and a plentiful supply of ammunition," Walter said.
"And you supply them," Forrester said.
He smiled.
"Hey, here's a battery of cannon, no questions asked."
"I will not say yes and I will not say no, but it is always possible that I deal in arms of all kinds, and that I use the Earl as my go-between in those transactions. If that were the case, and I don't say that it is, I would pay him handsomely, and keep him in line with five-pound notes, threats of blackmail, and worse."
Forrester smiled.
"In other words, Mr. Walter, you're a world-class gunrunner."
"Gunrunner?
Yes, that's another of those new, crude, and hurtful American terms, and one I would never use," Walter said, frowning.
"If I engaged in such a business, I'd call myself a contraband weapons dealer."
Forrester made no comment on that. He said,
"Gideon Stark has all the weapons he needs. What he does need are men who can use them."
"And he has them. Four of the best I could find," Walter said.
Forrester shook his head.
How did one of the biggest ranchers in Texas ever shove his branding iron into your fire, Walter?
The older man smiled. His branding iron into my fire.
That's a colorful way of putting it. But here's how it might have happened, the very nub of the matter, you might say.
Walter took time to pour more sherry, and Forrester said, "You'll make me drunk."
"I doubt it," Walter said. He sipped from his own glass, the crystal engraved with an elaborate coat of arms. Forrester guessed it was Russian, judging by the double-headed eagle. And Walter said,
"Gideon Stark and the Earl's son, the young rancher I told you about earlier, share a fence and are neighbors and close friends. Do you already know that?"
"Stark told me only what I needed to know for this job," Forrester said. "He's a tight close-mouth man. He didn't mention an Englishman, neighbor or no."
"Ah, leaving no loose ends also applies to the hired help, huh?"
"I guess it's something like that," Forrester said.
Walter fell silent as a tall, thin, melancholy man dressed in butler black stepped into the room and added a log to the fire. He bowed slightly from the waist and said, "Will there be anything else, sir?"
Walter shook his head.
"No, Mr. Lewis, nothing more for today."
"Very well, sir," the butler said. "Mr. Forster's room has been prepared, and the fire's lit."
Walter nodded and said, "I took the liberty of assuming you'd sleep here tonight, Mr. Forster. I told the cabby to pick you up in the morning after breakfast. As you know, I'm very isolated here. One can't just step out of the front door and hail a passing cab."
"Suits me just fine," Forrester said. He glanced out the window. "Is that sleep, snow, or rain?"
"All three," Walter said. "And there might soon be thunder. British weather, you know."
He turned his attention to Lewis.
"You may take the rest of the day off to visit your ailing sister, isn't it?"
"Yes, my sister Ethel, sir," the butler said. "She's down with female hysteria and a wandering womb, and her husband's at his wit's end."
"So sorry to hear that," Walter said. "Your brother-in-law is in service?"
"Yes, sir. He's third footman to Lord Ransomere."
"Then take the pony trap, Mr. Lewis, and I'll see you tomorrow morning."
Lewis bowed. "Yes, sir. Thank you, sir." The butler glided silently to the door, and Walter called out after him,
"And, Mr. Lewis, for goodness sake, wear your oilskins and stay dry."
The butler turned and managed a ghost of a smile.
"Certainly, sir. It's very kind of you to be so concerned."
Walter waved a dismissive hand.
"Think nothing of it, Mr. Lewis."
The door closed noiselessly behind the butler, and Walter said, as though the interruption had not occurred,
"I wasn't there, of course, and this is all supposition, but I imagine Mr. Stark conversed with the Earl's son and happened to mention that he was looking for some skilled men to carry out an enterprise for him."
Forrester smiled. "Murder for him, you mean?"
"Yes, just that. But Mr. Stark likely stipulated that the assassins must be unknown to the American and Mexican authorities, and that after hitting their target they'd disappear back into their holes. Of course, the Earl's son would recommend me as a discreet man who can get things done."
"How would he know that?" Forrester said.
Walter shrugged. "I suspect the young man is privy to all his father's secret dealings. I gather from the Earl's letters that his son is not a stickler for the law and has hanged or shot many a man without trial."
"Wrestlers and nesters, probably," Forrester said. "Plenty of those in West Texas."
"Just so," Walter said. "Now let's be frank. It's time for some plain talk. Several months ago, Mr. Stark and myself entered into a correspondence during the course of which I agreed to help him by providing assassins. For a fee, of course."
Walter spread his thin-fingered hands and smiled.
"And now here you are, Mr. Forrester."
"The money's in my bag," the Texan said. "5,000 in gold."
"And?"
Walter prompted. "You'll get the other 5,000 when the job is done, and an additional sum to pay the returning killers."
"Quite acceptable," Walter said. Judging by his correspondence, Gideon Stark is a hard and bending man, but I judge him to be
Sample complete. Ready to continue?